8. Start to develop some faith and courage instead of fear. Start to develop some integrity. And lo and behold, what happens is that the scale starts to level out. And then sometimes when we just go to the total extreme. Sometimes I get so full of what's happening here that I can barely contain myself. And it just goes away over like this, you know. And I just want to fly, man. I just feel so good that I can barely contain myself. And that's what this is. It's this process of recovery to me. Is that I'm ready to have God remove these defects of character. And then as I take the actions, you know, and do that, the prayer, you know, we're asked to get rid of these shortcuts. You know, some people debate sometimes about, again, I think Kent hit it too, that about the difference between defects of character and omissions. Some people say Bill just didn't want to be redundant, so he used different words to say the same thing. I tell you what made sense to me about it is that a defect of character is that thing that produces that behavior. And it's evidenced by what you see me do. That's the evidence of the defect of character. The behavior reflects that defect. Shortcomings are what I don't do. They're what I don't do. And so it's two different things. That there's, in the Bible they call it sins of omission and sins of commission. And here I think that's what we're talking about is that there are many things that defects were the behavior. That's what anybody saw. There was a lot that nobody saw, and that's what I didn't do. That's what I failed to do. You know, that when I started looking at the other side of this kind of situation here, I told one side of it. You know, when I first came into the program, I was like a lot of people. I never hurt anybody but myself. Yeah. Yeah. Never hurt the family. At least I had the decency to be gone. You know, I didn't hurt them. They didn't know where I was. All I did was deprive a mother of a son. She didn't know if I was alive or dead. She had no clue. Now, how much more cruel punishment could you put on somebody than to take away the most important thing in the world to them? And so a whole bunch into both sides of that ledger with what I do and what I fail to do. And so this transaction was to become ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And I'm not a mystic type of guy. You know, I'm a pretty pragmatic fellow. And I believe the answer to that prayer is, okay, move on to step 8. I think that's the answer to the prayer. It's not some you pluck away, you know, some kind of thing like that. It's a plan of action. And what we have here is we have a God-inspired program of living, which if I take the actions, amazing things will happen and do. And so this transition, I think, I'll say this and then we'll take a little break. This transaction to me is a critically important one. And what happens, like I was saying earlier, that I think the best I can tell when I lose people, even if they don't go out, what they do is opt for an easier, simpler way. There is an easier, softer way. You don't have to go through these steps. There's an easier, softer way. And an awful lot of people get to this juncture, just like my guy that did the seven-hour fifth step. A lot of guys get to this juncture and they're either afraid of change or just don't have the guts to do it. I don't know what. Or don't feared of getting too good like I was. But a lot of people will pull away and I don't know if it's a deliberate decision, but will just sort of drift in to going to meetings with all kinds of frequency in the notion that the meetings are the solution. And it's a trap, you know, it's a trap. It's an easier, softer way. It's what I call pit stop AA, where we start seeing AA as some place to go and get what I want. Well, I would submit to you that that's a weird way to treat a self-centered condition is by making all the focus on me. I just don't believe that'll work. And so that's attractive. That's a very attractive thing. It beats what goes into making amends and to going back and making things right if what you're looking for is just an easy way out. And so I think that's one reason that it sort of shifts into that. And if you don't think that's popular, do a quick nose count of where we function. Do a quick nose count of around this country of how many real solid kind of gung-ho, purposeful, three legacy groups there are as compared to little places where folks just meet. So it's a very seductive trap. And I don't know if you could sell it. I don't know what it takes. I know that the stuff I've been doing in working with people in the book does it better than anything I've ever seen. But there is an easier, softer way. Unfortunately, it tends to lead to drinking. That most people I've seen who opt out of the recovery process and into the sort of hole pattern, it's usually absolutely limited in terms of quality recovery, and most of the time in terms of longevity of recovery. It just tends to be a kind of a, it stands to reason that if you get into a place and your only agenda is go get what you want, I mean, come on. It just stands to reason that sooner or later you're going to get saturated. I mean, how many times can you talk about gratitude in how many languages? And so naturally it's going to get to, and it does, gets to a point where, oh, Jesus, we own that again. Yeah, we just talked about that 3 months ago. Yeah, or you, Ivis, are speaking again. Good God, lock him up somewhere. Put him good away. Yeah, but it just stands to reason that's what's going to happen. Because what we have to do is learn how to be a channel, so that we're not just someplace where we gather up, but we really open up and become a flow so that we're reaching out and getting back into the mainstream of life. So, anyway, we'll bop around that neighborhood a little bit. And so let's take a little break and see you in a quarter hour or so, something like that. Going to change your pace a little and get into the ask it basket. You never know what you're going to get. And it's always... I try to read it with my squinty little eyes. Yeah, I've got some right here. That one's written small. I got it. Oh, yeah, there's something on there. Not attending a lot of meetings due to life on life's terms. Should I worry? Qualified worry. Yeah. I would go back to what I was talking about when somebody detours away from 6 and 7 and gets to thinking that meetings are the solution. You know, what I would be looking at if I had a limited agenda would be solidifying a real home group where you could make a real commitment and not just some sort of shotgun approach, to making a lot of meetings. Now some of that I qualified only in this sense that if you're within the first year of sobriety, I think it's awfully important to make a lot of meetings. You want to get acquainted with people, you want to meet folks, you want to have not a whole bunch of slack time. So there's a good rationale for that. But if you're somebody that's fairly well established in recovery and just not able because of the current deal, my notion would be, is I'm a group guy, would be to identify a group where you can realistically make a commitment. Because I think that commitment will make up for the volume of meetings. And if you get one or two a week at a place where it's an absolute commitment, would be my notion of where to go. Sometimes schedule's not going to let us get to do everything we want to do. We just have to do the best we can with what we got. But the group is a great place to get the solidifying staying power that you need. It's also a good place where people get to know you and you're not a stranger in a crowd. It's where somebody can read it if the life on life's terms getting to you. And so if you do that with a bunch of strangers, nobody's ever going to say, hey, what's going on with you? But if you get a group, you're going to be a lot more likely to find that. So That'd be my suggestion. Are the things that interfere with emotional sobriety revealed to us in steps 4 and 5? I don't think automatically they are. That a lot of times they're not going to come under the heading of resentment or fear or something like that. Yeah, I think you'll sort of get into the neighborhood, but to make a direct relationship, because some of the stuff we were talking about, in at least the ones I laid out, probably some of them would not make the inventory deal. I just take a look at those kinds of things that make your own list, but look at those kinds of things that I mentioned that interfere. A lot of those are more 10th step kind of issues than they are 4th step. Because it's a whole different level of intensity and thoroughness involved. And so 10th step would be the place where I would be taking a look at those things that are starting to interfere with good, sound emotional sobriety. The question makes the point that there is established sobriety that we're talking about. And so I would look first to the 10th step and not the 4th. Just one guy's opinion, naturally. I can't give the credit on this. I will only tell you that he talks funny. I'll just read it with the guy that talks funny's permission. Nod, George. Yeah, okay. Yes, an anonymous person. Question basically, what is emotional sobriety? And it's a good question, really, that emotional sobriety. Bill's article gives some pretty good information about it, at least the way he was looking at it. And he was talking about things like balance, that have to do with emotional sobriety, where you've got a good solid hold on this thing, and you're not caught into so many things that pull you off task. And he was caught up a lot in that message I got in it was that it was the concern about backing away from active helping people. And getting into too much of self stuff is what I really read between the lines in it. But emotional sobriety, I think that personally that it would not be all that helpful to establish that as a new category of AA work. That it's a description of something that has to do with the quality of sobriety, and that's what Bill was taking off on, I think. But it's like I said in the beginning, for the overwhelming majority of us, just diligent work, practicing the principles are going to take care of this stuff. And there'll be times when we'll get off the beam a little bit, like he was talking about. And Bill made that presentation in an article that I don't think he meant to write a new manual. That what he was talking about doing was just sort of tuning up a side of the program. I think where we'll spend a good bit of time, mainly just because of my own bias, is we've got two more steps that deal with sort of the healing process, where we're starting to get stuff going. And then I think we make a very important, deliberate change of course when we get into 10, 11, and 12. Where we start moving away from an inordinate amount of self-focus and start to look at our gains as coming from efforts we make with others. And so I'm always real pleased. Often when I'm not going to do it this time, but often if I'm just making a talk on step, I get caught up in stuff and shortchange what I think is one of the most critically important parts in the program. And that's those steps where we start practicing this as a way of life with all the joys and rewards and benefits that come. And so that's kind of a long, kind of a ranging answer to that thing, George. But I think that's what he was getting at. And the way he defines that in that article, it's certainly worthy of thought. You know, that's for doggone sure. And it's serious enough that a group of people have said, let's put a workshop together where we focus on this as an agenda item. And so, yeah, good investment of time, and it's a worthwhile thing. Uh-oh. Choosing to marry someone out of the rooms instead of someone in the rooms of AA. I say amen. That's just one guy's opinion, but it is one that I think is worthy of some serious consideration. Yeah, there's I think we've all run into the treatment center romances where it's going to last forever, and does till next Friday, and it's one of those things where when I'm working with somebody that gets enamored of somebody in the program. Well, let me go back just a little bit forward to a little bit more kind of a rigid stance. When I came in the program, it was absolutely beaten into me that women in AA are not women. They're alcoholics. And you don't deal with them as women, you deal with them as alcoholics. And I'll guarantee you, the first several years I was in AA, I would have rather French kissed a cobra than to. That is a sick thought, isn't it? But I'll guarantee you, there was no way I was going to. Man, I thought maybe something was going to just fall on me out of heaven or something if I even looked long at a woman. And so I was raised in that culture that you just, it's not a matter of when to do it or how to do it or whether to do it, it's don't do it. You know, they just ain't gonna do it. And, I got involved with one AA woman, and fortunately, we both got through it. But I saw the wisdom because there are some real challenges in that. And I'm no expert on it whatsoever, but I've worked with a lot of people dealing with this thing. There's some real challenges when you get two people with common kinds of problems rather than the notion that we strengthen each other. It looks like we have as much conflict as we do. Now, there are a lot of AA marriages that work out and work out very well. There are a lot that don't. You know, it looks to me like the odds are just about as good in AA is out of AA, in all reality, that, you know, somewhere a little less than 50% of marriages tend to culminate into long-term marriages. And so that's not all that much. I guess what I'm really getting at is that if I'm working with somebody and they start to get involved with someone in the program, what I ask them to do is make it pass every test. Make it pass every test. Don't just take it for granted that it's going to be wonderful. Make it pass the test. Are you genuinely committed to this person? Are you genuinely willing to be engaged to this person rather than just getting a cohabiting situation? Are you really willing to go through the proper... Well, you never know up here in Ohio. but you know what I mean? It's make it pass the test. And I won't go into any details enough to identify who I'm talking about, but I was sponsoring a person of great integrity and great spiritual quality, and he fell in love with a lady. She was an Al-Anon. She was not fellow A, but she's Al-Anon. And they're both really people that I thought you had gone to the trouble to get really solidly endowed in the church, got really back so that there was spiritual soundness in all directions. And it came to a point where it was going to be convenient and economical for them. They were going to move to a different town to go live together. And, sometimes I'd be a little looser than others, but that time, owing to the type of people, one of the tests I said was, why don't you do it right? Why don't you just do it right? Why don't you do an engagement? Why don't you set up a marriage? Why don't you do it right? And both of them are deeply grateful today. Their marriage is intact and has been for 20 years, I imagine. So a lot depends. There's not a pat answer on that kind of thing. It's who you're dealing with and how to deal. But my basic deal is that it's a risk any way you put it. And making the assumption that it's going to be just a marriage made in heaven because we're both in AA, it's a fallacy. It sounds wonderful to have wall-to-wall AA 24 hours a day, but we don't want that. Yeah. And it starts to get icky and sticky sometimes. You know, so you got to have that little place in there, I believe. The only other thing that it doesn't relate exactly to that thing, but I just throw it in with no extra cost, is I think it's tremendously important to give newcomers a chance to recover. And in all candor, I think one of the cruelest things we can do is get involved with somebody who's brand new in this program, and what we usually wind up doing is robbing them of a chance to recovery. And I think it's just a cruel and inconsiderate thing to do to somebody. So this whole business about relationships, I think, has a lot to do with the readiness, with the situation, with the type of person, and not just a standard. And that's just an Ivester deal. That's not party line of the fellowship. But anyway, good, very important question. Because we tend to fall in love with folks we hang out with. Yeah. By the way, yeah, I won't even go into that. I tell you, there's no magic formula. I'm married twice since I've been sober. One time when I was 5 years sober, and I thought I was pretty well alone, but it was a bad mistake. We divorced, and primarily we just were totally separated in regard to the program. She had different notions about what the social life of a married couple ought to be than me, and so we just sort of drifted apart. We didn't fight, we just sort of drifted into the Cold War. And swore I'd never do it again. But you know, I mentioned that I had never had a real committed relationship. I made a mistake. My wife is in Alana, she's not in the program, but I made a mistake. I swore I wouldn't marry anymore. I went up into Saskatchewan, up in Western Canada. I think women may get more lonely there than. I was speaking at a conference, and the lady who's my wife was working for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. You guys know about them. Very, very prim and proper outfit. She's working in the regional headquarters for Mounted Police. So I'm in town, and these folks just went all wild out. They protected anonymity, but just barely. Yeah. So I'm in town, and it's all over the news, the papers, the radio, the television, that there's some ex-con warden in here from North Carolina. And the guy that's my sponsor now introduced me to this lady because I made it was a language problem. These guys thought they were the AA center of the universe. And were so gung-ho that I was really trying to prick their balloon a little bit. So I noticed they didn't have any female members, like we were talking about. And so I said, I guess you don't have women in this province. Well, they didn't understand the terminology. They thought I was lonely. And, and, and so, So they set up a deal. I had no clue. I was as innocent as a lamb. They set up a deal where we went to lunch, and she was staked out to look me over and see if she'd be willing to meet me. And she said, "I will try it." And so we got her going. And I sponsored her on an alien visa to move to North Carolina. And there, you know, we didn't live together. We dated for 3 years. And I went down slow. I really meant it when I said I wasn't going to do it anymore. But I thought I did. But I made a bad mistake. Fell in love with that girl. Amazing what that'll do to barriers. And what happened was probably the most beautiful thing in my life. Where I not only was able to make a full commitment, but wanted to be that lady's husband. For me, that's a little remarkable, I'll tell you. And I've been a decent husband. I'm in abstentia a lot, but I'm something when I'm there. So anyway, yeah, there's no real point to that other than that when it comes along, you know it. You know it. And it wouldn't make any difference if it was an entry in the Kentucky Derby. You couldn't stop them anyway. You're gonna get going. So I wish you well. And in the room or out, it's got to be the real thing. I hate, and this is not a bad thing to hate to admit. I hate to admit it, but I don't understand the term three legacy group. Well, I mentioned about, and by the way, you know, the reason I say it's not a thing to be ashamed, I was sitting in a workshop out in Colorado a while back. I wasn't doing it. I was just sitting in the audience. And there was, I asked a question of the folk doing a workshop, and then a lady in the audience asked a question of my question. And all it was I had asked something about CPC. And of course, everybody knows what CPC means. But just in case, yeah. And she said the same thing. She said, "I hate to admit this, but I'm 22 years sober. I don't know what CPC means. What is it?" And I said, "Well, it's cooperation with the professional community." And I said, "Don't be ashamed by all means, because what you've just done is identified yourself with probably 75% of the fellowship. I'm not proud of that. But you can be sure that many of our vital services are in limbo at best. And that's a vital one. You know, I won't go into it, but if you think back to the origination of AA right close to where we sit, and you look at the absence of the professional community, you could pretty well thump it up on where we would be. So the professional community has had a long and valuable relationship to our fellowship. And over the years, what we have done is just quit nurturing that so that that's a badly, badly underutilized kind of service that I think is vital. So a three legacy group, I mentioned about the meetings where it tends to be a one-note samba. You know, it's the legacy of those is recovery, period. That's one legacy. It is a vital legacy. It's spelled out in our 12 steps, you know, and it is the legacy of recovery. That's fundamental to what we do. If we don't recover, the rest of it's philosophy. But so that's one. The other is unity that's embodied in our traditions about how we can work in unity within our fellowship and within our world. You know, how can we make our group be an effective instrument in the overall work of AA? And that's a legacy of how we can be in unity with our purpose. So we get so steeped in recovery that we forget that there's a whole world out there that aren't here. Yeah. And so unity not only helps us work well, but it helps us serve well so that we're an active part of carrying this message. And then the third one is service. We were talking about the Chicago convention with somebody at the break. That's where I had the conflict, yeah. At that sentence, you probably see it right here. They had a badge, which I just loved. It says, service is the secret. And I'll tell you something. I love that badge because that is an absolute fact. Service is the secret. It's just like Bill was talking about in this emotions. Right? What he's talking about was that his service loop was sagging. He wasn't actively working with people. And to my money, the secret to sound sobriety, to joyful sobriety, to real recovery, to having a wonderful kind of life in recovery, is in service, not in self-serving. And I really believe that. So a three-legacy group is one that embodies those legacies. My home group is kind of like we were talking about. I live in Mayberry, not literally, but it looks like it. No, it's not. It's a fancy resort, and we specialize in enticing folks from Ohio and Pennsylvania to come down there and spend a lot of money, and a lot of them stay. So, but anyway, it's a small town, and our group, it's not the best group in the world. Ours is a sound group. We're a three-legacy group. We've got a strong recovery program. Every time we meet on Monday night, we have a big book study, a big book discussion, a step meeting, and a newcomer meeting, all meeting at the same time so that we can do more than one thing. We can actually walk and chew gum. And we just finished our group inventory, which is one of the ways of assuring that we're in unity with each other and that we're working and with the groups around us. And then service, if you look at it, like most places, we got steps and traditions. We got that too. But we also have an activity board, which says all of the things that we've got committed for that next week. In my little old town, and it's not bragging, it's just a fact. It's what a three-legacy group ought to look like. We have four commitments in hospitals, detox, and treatment centers. We have four commitments in penitentiaries. We've got active CPC. We've got active PI. Have an active grapevine deal, a newsletter. And this is all in Mayberry. So a three-legacy group, I don't mean to sound like you got to have a Rolls Royce. All that is a place where people can genuinely get into service and not talk about it. Get into it and do something. And so somebody walks in our group, they can get a job day one. May not have them making a speech, but they can lick a stamp. Or tote a box or something, So anyway, that's what a three-legacy group is one where you've got all of the things. I'll tell you just one bias of mine. I believe any group that doesn't have active service beyond the walls of the meeting is a group that's shortchanging itself. Because those things are just like Bill was talking about. Those are the things that bring it alive. And make it happen and make it sing. And so whoever asked that question probably didn't have in mind for me to get into all that. but that is so true, though. As a three-legacy group, is nothing in the world but just a well-ordered group where we carry out the full program of AA and not just one minor sliver. Yeah, thank you, love. I won't grab you like I did that guy. I've learned better. slip, fear. Oh, slip. Yeah, lose sobriety, loses its priority. Fear is forget. These are the acronyms for fear is forget everything and run. Yeah. Hey. What do you think? Well, I think it's a pretty darn good acronym, and it's a reasonable definition of a slip. I tell you the strange thing about slips that I've come to believe is that the average slip starts at least 6 months before the drink. And I don't know whether it's something losing a priority or something. It's at least losing the aggressive, moving, positive relationship to the program. And you think about it, I know you've seen the same thing. It's a weird thing But anybody can recognize when somebody's headed for trouble. Old folks, you remember we did a workshop a little within our group. We did a little thing one time. We were talking in the heading of working with others. And one of the things we agreed on in our group was just that, that you can recognize when somebody's headed for trouble. But we're almost all equally puzzled about how to deal with it. And so we beat that around for a couple of hours. What we wound up with, and I was just talking with somebody right before we started, what we wound up with is that that somebody needs to do something, but the person who needs to do it is the person who has the greatest level of trust. Because if you don't have that trust, what you'll do is make it worse. If you go crashing in on somebody where you don't have that trust established, it won't happen. You'll do more harm than good. A strange thing about alcoholics, what my experience has been that once you develop real trust with an alcoholic, you might as well fasten your seatbelt because it's a lifetime thing. Lifetime thing. And you can do almost anything you want to with somebody when you've got that trust. And if you don't, you stand a real good chance of doing more harm than good. So it's a strange thing, but that's what I believe about SLIPS. That's not a bad acronym, but that is a slip of how to intervene is a tricky terrain. Forget everything and run. That's a good one for fear. Yeah, I'll just say right on with that. Forget everything and run. By the way, if anybody wants to add anything to any of this stuff, Kent, old man, I haven't called on you guys. If y'all want to add anything, just have at it. Or just let me just dive. I've overworked. When you want to surround your life with God and recovery, we're going to come back to this in some detail in the last three steps, but when you want to surround your life with God and recovery, how do you balance that with relationships so it doesn't hinder either one of you? Well, that's a huge challenge, and that's not an unusual challenge for any of us, I think, particularly if you get involved in service, if you really get actively involved in service. Just going to meetings, that's sort of come and go, you know, stuff. You could cut that off fairly easily. But when you get involved in service, most of us who get heavily involved in service have to deal with a real troubling question. Is what I'm trying to do here tearing down the things that are really important to me? Am I doing this at the expense of my family? Am I doing it at the expense of my job? I think all of us who get caught up in this thing and really get involved in service have that challenge of how do we do this and still maintain our responsibility. Now, I said half in jest that my wife would be the one to really report on my overcommitment. Because practically every weekend of my life, I'm off doing something like this. And between this, I don't mean just this, but doing something. And between this, I've got commitments, things that I do in my home group and in my prison and other stuff around the state. So yeah, it's a very busy life, and it's a very demanding life. I tell you what I found now, and this is because it is a troubling kind of a question. If you're somebody that's getting into that, or you're in it now, a bit of a critical thing. What I found is that the principles are the key. Everything that I do in my life of any importance is based in principles. My marriage is based in principles. It's based in a vow that I made to be that husband I want to be. Those are important principles. When I'm employed, a principle there is that you show up and you do your work, that you take care of it, that you put your company first, that's important. There are principles of that. On and on with all those things. So naturally, they really pose a challenge for somebody who's really active in AA. What I found, and I'm as busy as anybody I have ever met, and that's the God's truth. And like anybody, I've been involved with a very heavy, demanding, high-pressure career, most of which I created. I just do it that way. But it was a very important career to me. I've been involved in that. I had a family. My wife and I just celebrated 38 years of continuous marriage. We had a couple of kids. Used to. They're old people now. But they still hang around, want something. But, you know, what they want is us. Those are important things. What I found is that when I operate by principles and genuinely try to do what's right, my activity in AA does not compete with anything in my life. Now, that takes more than just some little bland statement to say that's the way it is. You have to make that happen. I was talking about commitment earlier. I think commitment is an extremely important ingredient in having a workable kind of relationship, where it's a difference between a commitment where folks close to me know what my commitments are. They know. I'll give you an example. My son is he's a physician, and tried to get him to get into a decent field, but he didn't. He's a high-risk specialist in maternal fetal medicine. He couldn't get sued enough just being a regular OBGYN. He started to make a few bucks. And one night he was visited at the home, and the point is about how this works. You know, when you got commitments, that commitments tells you what you're going to do, and they also tell you that everything else is under a different heading. So we're sitting just he and I chatting, and he said, "Hey, Dad, yeah, I'd like to take you guys out to dinner tonight." And I said, "Well, that's real generous of you. I'm glad." No, I didn't. I didn't say anything at first. Later, I said it's generous, but I didn't say anything. And I don't know if I showed a flicker or what, or he just thought. But he said, "Oh, wait a minute, this is your group night." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, well, heck, we'll do it different." Now, suppose I'd have said to him, "No, I'm going to go hang out with Tony tonight." That would not have been the same thing. Yeah, you know, what that would have said is Tony's more important than you. See what I'm talking about? So if it's a commitment, it's bound in integrity. And people can trust me to do what I say I'm going to do. They can trust me to be there on that night. So they can plan around that. You know, they honor that commitment, just like he did. And we did go out to dinner somewhere. And he paid. I couldn't believe it. And so what I do, my calendar is an open book. And now I can't wait till Thursday before I fly out on Friday to say, "Hey, I want you to do this." So what to do is take the calendar, write it in. You want to do something? You want to plan a vacation? You want to go goof off somewhere? You want to buy a hot dog? Go show off? You know, whatever. All I got to do is put it on the book.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a commitment. So that's what I'm talking about with principles. You know, it's not an easy thing, but it's something you got to have some honesty and integrity. Sometimes, and I tell you the worst thing I think we can do, sometimes we approach it by almost saying that if it's AA, it has the holy blessing, you know, that it's God's work. Yeah, if it's AA. That AA is the most important thing in my life. Now, I don't say that because I don't believe that. My recovery is the most important thing in my life. That's a different statement. Everything I do in AA does not have holy water sprinkled on it. Sometimes I'm just goofing off. Yeah. So you see what I'm talking about? Yeah, that's an important question. I dwell on that just a little bit because it is so frequently troubling for so many of us who really get involved in this thing. And so I think the real secret is in that thing of having clear, solid, well-understood commitments. And my wife will correct me in a heartbeat. If I start to agree to something, she'll say, "No, you can't do that." "Why not?" She said, "Well, you go to prison." And I, "Oh, okay, excuse me." You know, so she's part of it. And so it not only sort of defines the channels for me to work, But don't miss that word I said is trust. If people trust me to do what I say I'm going to do, then they know how to deal with me. But if I'm sort of a chameleon that you can't figure out what he's going to do next, that's going to drive everybody nuts. And so I think it is a critically important question. I didn't mean to beat it to death. But if we don't resolve that kind of thing, it can give us a fit. It can really give us a fit. Anything else on that, anybody? Yeah. Okay. If you are not sponsoring someone, should I worry that I am not helping someone? What do you think? Well, I put it this way. If I believe that if you're much over a year sober, you ought to be sponsoring somebody. Yeah. And it's not a holy mission, but it's like the book says, you know, in that chapter on working with others, you remember that little two paragraph? What it talks about is the marvelous reward of ensuring your sobriety by actively trying to help somebody else. That it works when nothing else does. It works. And then the second part of that is to see somebody come alive in front of you that has trusted you to be part of their life. The book says that's an experience you must not miss. And that is powerful. That is powerful. When you can really feel that sense of just like my buddy in Dundee. I had to go over there because I told him that's what we were going to do. So, my short answer would be that I really believe it's important. And if nobody's asking you, you might want to review why not. And if at a minimum, you ought to be an active agent with other people wherever you go. Wherever you go. I don't care whose group it is. It's not unusual at all for me to go to a group and welcome people to their own home group. I don't mind doing that one bit. Because, you know, for somebody like me that was isolated and reluctant to get involved with people, that's not gregarious fellowship. That's therapy. Because that keeps me from being isolated. That keeps me from backing off. And so I would say if you're not sponsoring anybody, at least get into that habit of reaching out to somebody. And it's not hard. I mean, you don't have to be Dale Carnegie. I mean, if you see somebody, pick the saddest looking dude in the room and just go over there and say a kind word. Say, hey, good to see you. I don't believe I know you. My name is Henry. Yeah, just take that move. Or say, glad to see you here. I don't care if you hate him. Just tell him, I'm glad to see you here, you know. And what that does is starts to impact on that self-centered thing of being cut off from people. And that's what sponsorship is. It's just a more intense way of being related to people. And so at a minimum, you know, I think something like that is essential to do. I don't want AA to be an unfriendly place. I really don't. But I'm telling you, you go to some meetings, and I swear to God, it looks like a wake. And that's a fact. I went into one a while back. I won't name the place. I don't know point in naming it. It's on the West Coast. I put it that way. And I was just happened. My wife and I were bumming around. I had to be out there 2 weeks in a row, so we took a week and just goofed off and played and stuff. And so we stopped in this town and staying over. And I said, I think I'll check out. I like to go to meetings that where I just sort of see how they do it in Podunk. So I called up and finally chased down a meeting. They told me the wrong room number, but I got enough sense to find a meeting most of the time. So I went over there and smelled a coffee and found them. And I went in. There were three people sitting there, a good old boy and his wife and his teenage son. And I said, okay, fine. So I walk in. I mean, they didn't even acknowledge. I mean, I could have been a water buffalo coming in there. They paid no attention to that. And so I tolerated that for about 30 seconds or so. Then I went over there and interrupted whatever they were doing. Yeah. There was nothing obtrusive about that. I just went over and said, hey, I'd like to meet you. I'm Tom Ivester from North Carolina. Glad to meet you. How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? And so we did that stuff, and then they reverted back to doing whatever they were doing. And then some others started to straggle in, and so I became the greeter for the group. And so I'm over greeting folk and greeted the waiter. Not the waiter, the guy, the orderly. Greeted him. He just came in that room, and he wasn't even a member, but I welcomed him anyway. He may want to join sometime. But you see what I'm talking about? If I had gone in there and waited for those folks to make me glad I came, I'd have been one sad turkey when I left there. So you know, I'm a part of that. I'm not going to be a victim of that kind of thing. I'm going to make a difference. I'll tell you one other thing that happens with that. I went into a town not too far from where I live. And I was going around just. Tony had a leg attack.
Yeah.
Oh, it's his telephone. I went into this place and I just kind of worked in the crowd, you know, I just wandered around. And I met this lady and I went over to the other side of the room and a couple minutes later she came over and she said, can I ask you a personal question? I said, well, yeah, sure, go ahead. And she said, what do you sell? And I said, nothing. And I said, no, wait a minute, I do. I said, I sell recovery. And we got a heck of a deal on it.
Yeah.
Now, that was the truth, because that's what I do. You know, the program of attraction is us. It's us. It's not billboards and TV shots. The program of attraction is us. And if I think I want to help somebody to hook into AA, just by sitting there like a house plant, ain't gonna happen. And who was it talking about? I don't know if it's Kim, but anyway, somebody was talking about that power of that handshake. You know, you're guilty, Kim. I believe you would say it anyway if you didn't. But the power of that, you know, when somebody feels like he's at the end of the world, and you can just reach out a hand. Good God, you never know what a message that is. So that's a powerful thing. And so that'd be a kind of a left-handed approach to sponsorship, where you at least start getting out of that sort of self-centered lockdown. And if you go make somebody else welcome, be amazed what happens to you. Yeah. That's sneaking up on it. Can I keep coming back even if people are getting sick of me being in and out? Also, where could I be? Where could I be? This is, if I am back and forth so much, what could I be missing if I'm? Now I'm a pretty simple-minded type of fella. I'm a pretty simple-oriented type of fella. I would suspect that what you're missing is nothing profound. What you're missing is some real simple truisms about AA. Number one, be absolutely sure you're alcoholic. If you're an alcoholic, then ask yourself a second question. Do you want to get sober? Do you want to be sober? Third, do you believe you can make it for one day? Now, those are real kindergarten questions, but they are basic, fundamental to getting started in this program of recovery. And so making it depends on how you define it. If you think 49 years defines it, no. If you can do that, answer those questions, and make it one day, you're an absolute winner for that day. You've got exactly the same kind of authority in AA that I do. You're as much of a member as I am. So I'd say just to keep it nitty-gritty, you're not missing some mysterious thing. It's a matter of getting that absolutely rock-solid commitment. Yes, I'm an alcoholic. Yes, I want to stay sober. Yes, I can make it for one day, and if I can, I'll make it for an hour. That was exactly what the program was when I came in. It was not some esoteric stuff. And so those basic fundamental things, if you do that, you can't go wrong. And so that'd be what I suggest. It's not what you message. It's just those simple little basic things. Satisfy yourself with that. What happens every time you make a day, your morale inches up. Your morale and spirit inches up. Because that's the one in the victory column. And you feel good. Then you do it again and you feel a little better. And that's what we do. We just put those days together. And they turn into weeks and months and years. So, man, I've never done it. But God knows how many people I have walked through that tragedy of coming in and going out. The real tragedy is that the more you come in and go out, the more often you do it. So I'd say put a stop to that sucker and dig in there and give it everything you got. Treat it like your life depends on it, because it probably does. The four absolutes, honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. Share your thoughts on it. I'll tell you what one of my thoughts is, that the utilization of those is confined to a sort of area surrounding Ohio. That's the only place of fellowship that I know of where the absolutes, they're not unknown. But here, they're part of daily routine. You know, they're very common. They grew here, and they still remain here. I don't know of any place else in the country where the absolutes have the role in the program that they do here. They obviously are not a part of our core curriculum, so to speak. You know, that they're something that people found to be useful. I use a lot of stuff. But I do it, you know, personally, at a personal level. I do a lot of stuff. I read a lot of stuff. The absolutes scared me when I first looked at it. I thought, my God, man, I was scared of getting better. Never mind perfect. And when I started thinking about absolute purity, absolute love, God, those, I thought, what an order. I can't even try. So anyway, that my thoughts don't mean a whole lot because my thoughts are greater than my experience. I did not grow up with them, and they're still. Somebody asked me to do a workshop on the absolutes up here one time, and I respectfully declined. I said, let me do it on something else, because I just don't believe in trying to convey something that you don't really have real commitment to. Whereas you really have, it's a part of your living experience, and so I didn't do it. So They're about as pristine as could be in terms of their origin. They came in with the first folks who came in here. And you guys have hung on to them. Doesn't do any harm. I suspect it probably does some good. I don't know. I would sure be interested in learning more about how you use those. I've never seen how they're utilized here that much. Just other than just seeing them around. I'd be really interested in that. I'd try to have an open mind about stuff. One more, I believe. This is a longer one. Why don't sponsors express the 12 traditions as much as the steps and the advantages of applying them to their lives? To the weekend, is AA traditions too advanced for newer members? Well, I certainly tell you what I think. Traditions are vital to me. They're vital and valuable to me. Strangely enough, it may be strange, I don't know if it is or not, traditions were the first thing that gave me vision in AA. They were the first thing. Because I was fumbling with the steps, and then I started to get into tradition. And that's where I saw that AA was more than just a handful of drunks meeting in a church basement for an hour. I started to see that we're talking about a life-changing fellowship that reaches literally around this world. And that vision clicked with me. And so ever since then, traditions have always had a real vital kind of a role in my life. I'll tell you this, and then I'll get to what the specific question was, but I'll tell you this, I use AA tradition. That's not just podium chatter. That's a fact. I use the traditions in every area of my life. I use them in my marriage, in my family. I used them throughout my professional career when I was employed. I used them far more than anything I learned in university, because what they are is a group of principles that tell us how to work together, that tell us how to be unified in a purpose. My God, what's a marriage? Yeah. And I find absolutely nothing about the traditions that doesn't relate to me 100% personally. That thing I threw in about money, property, and prestige that I had on one of these things, that's a tradition. Yeah. Sixth tradition. We normally think about it about buying buildings or stuff like that. But you think about the impact of something like that in a family. Let me give you one little case history on that, about how it works. And I'll just use that one. It would fit either that one or another one. I forgot the other one. But we had a deal in our family. Just to show you the use of this, and then I'll end with answering the question. But we had a thing in our family that I know we're the only family in America that did this, but we went nuts about Christmas. And we started just built up so that we made a pure joke out of Christmas. It was a spending orgy of just buying a bunch of gifts, most of which we're not all that appreciated. Our kids had toys that they never opened. Yeah, we just absolutely loaded them down. Well, I didn't like that, but I'm just one guy in the family. But I just didn't like it. And so finally one day, I said, shoot, we ought to talk about this. So I just asked everybody to sit down. I said, let's just talk about something. And we've talked about tradition a lot. I said, let's take a look at what we do at Christmas. And I said a bit. Didn't want to sell them a lot. I said, let's just share what you think about that. Now, I thought my wife was the driving force in that. We have four members in my immediate family. Four members despised what we were doing. But every one of us felt duty-bound and obligated to do it because it was expected. And so we concluded, our analysis of that was, that's pretty dumb. We wanted heavy language. That's pretty dumb. And so what we decided, we put a max of what we could spend on any gift, $50. Put a max. And I thought you were bringing me something. We put a max on that thing. And then we made it, we adopt a family. So what we do is adopt a family that won't have any Christmas if somebody doesn't adopt them. My God, what a difference, eh? Now that's tradition, yeah? That's just nothing in the world except that tradition that we don't get into all this kind of stuff. Money, property, and prestige will divert us from our spiritual aim. Our aim is not to have a spending orgy. Our aim is to love each other, to have real marriage, real family. And so tradition, God knows, it's just so valuable. And they literally, a lot of times, if I do a workshop on tradition, I always do it from a personal perspective about how they are personally. What I find about traditions, if I understand them at a personal level, it's easy to expand that to a group once I understand the principle. So I think they're enormously valuable. I really don't know why we, the thing about why don't sponsors or groups do more of this thing, I don't think there's really a good answer to that. A lot of time we don't do it because we're ignorant in it. We just don't know enough about it or don't put enough value on it. If you think about it, we don't have sponsor schools anywhere that I know of. It's kind of like parenthood. We don't train parents. You just have babies. Same thing with sponsorship. People take on the job like we're just talking about. If you got over a year, you ought to be doing it. And nobody tells you how. You just sort of do it like somebody did it to you. And so there's no thing. If you think about, think about this a minute. You think about any city you want to think about. And you look at the overwhelming preponderance of meetings in your area. I'll give you $100 for everyone that does one on traditions if you'll give me $1 for everyone that doesn't. You better believe it. So where would you learn that? Where would you learn the about the value of making traditions a part of what the message is that you carry? Where would you learn service? Where would you learn about self-support? That average place where we take up a collection, we say no dues or fees, but we got to buy coffee. That's the least important thing we do with our money. But that's what we talk about. When we look at these deficit areas, we got to look at what we're doing to make a difference. And the sad question is, very little. Very little. So it's a real concern as a whole area unto itself, but it's a big area. I'll tell you one other thing about tradition that it relates to tradition. When you don't get into the mainstream, if you just let yours be just an hour in a church basement, it's what you miss. It's what you miss. It's like I say, if it's not an active thing outside the walls of the meeting, it's being shortchanged. I'll give you an example, and I'm just another member down in Mayberry. But if you get real active in service, people are aware that you're active in it. And I got a call. I wouldn't take anything for this. I got a call from a fellow at the General Service Office in New York, and he said, "Tom, I got a guy down in Kenya in Africa that's really got a problem on his hands that he wants to do something about. He wants to get AA going in the prisons in Kenya." And he said, "I sent him some material and I told him that I knew a fellow that might be willing and able to help." And he said, "I didn't give him your name because I hadn't talked to you yet, but would you do it?" I said, "Man, I'd be tickled to death. I'd be tickled to death." There's two points that I hope come through in this. One, the guy at the General Service Office did exactly what we employ him to do. He's not there to do service. He's there to facilitate getting service done. So what he did was send a box of material to the fella. I don't think it was in Swahili or whatever they speak. I don't know what it was in. But that box of material went there because of that collection that we take. No collection, no box to Kenya. So it's more. God knows it's so much more than just buying coffee or some. That's just basic essentials. And so I'm glad of that. And I'm glad that guy at the office did exactly what he did. He should not have gone any further. He called a regular member and said, "Will you try to help?" So I got in touch with this guy. You talk about things that add to your life, eh? Got in touch with him. His name's Michael. Very articulate fellow. I haven't caught his whole background yet. We're busy doing something else, but I want to find out where he came from. Very articulate man. We do email. Thank God for high tech stuff. Can you imagine what it cost to get back and forth on the phone? Jesus. Man, it'd put me in jail for bad debts if I started doing stuff. But what we're doing is trying to get the movement going. So, and we got it underway. I won't give you too much detail on this. I'd be glad to privately if you want to know. But he said, we need some help. And he said, we've got quite a mess down here. And I said, well, describe your system to me. And he said, well, I don't know how to do that. And this is just back and forth. He said, ask me some questions and I can answer it and I can give it better. And he was right. I just happened to send 12 questions. I don't know why I thought of 12. But I sent 12 questions. And they're the obvious questions. How many places? Where are they? What kind of resource base you got? You got any people doing it? What's your transportation situation? I suspected what the answers would be, and it was dismal on every one. And I said, okay, fine, that's where we start. You know, so automatically I started thinking about we've got to get rotating teams of people. If you only got one car, bring five people to one point, help pay for the gas. You know, that's, don't buy it in Scotland. God almighty, they robbed me over there. I've got a report to y'all, they robbed me. But see, they got no money, and they got no cars, and if they got a car and got no gas, but it's what a great opportunity, eh? And so I told him, I said, well, first you got to get some information. I was talking about going to the heads of the facility to see if they were open to it. Well, he didn't quite understand my message. So he thought I meant information to the people who were locked up. So he sent me a picture on the email thing. Big, and I blew it up way up here. He'd got 600 African folk sitting on the ground. And he's up on the little raised place giving them information. He sent that message and he said, okay, I got them. Now what I do with them? So anyway, Dad, but it just is what a hoot, eh? And what an opportunity. Here, just a little simple thing like that. And we've got the opportunity to bring a program to an entire nation. Where there's nothing. And man, I'm telling you, I am so thrilled about that. It's just great. And the prison where the old fella and I do our primary service stuff, when they get their group up, we're going to get our group at the prison to communicate with the group starting there. But isn't that something? Now see, if I just thought in narrow terms, I would have never even thought of something like that. And so that's what I'm talking about. When you talk about these things, it's a good question because it identifies a part of the program where we just barely peck at it. And what it does is open up a whole world so that we can really do something. And so that's an exciting question, you can tell, that I think just does so much. So I would surely encourage when you start planning meetings or something, maybe if you get to be chair, bring up traditions. You know, that, just sucker punch them with it. And somebody asked me to do you do sucker punch sometimes. Somebody asked me to do a program on service at a group, the oldest group in our area. I don't think it ever been one in the history of that group. And I said, I'll be glad to do it, provided you tell them. You know, you let them have fair warning so they can hide if they don't want to be involved with it. So she said, okay, I'll do that. So I got there. We walk it in, and she said, I lied to you. I said, what about? She said, I didn't tell them. So we had a house full of people. And we talked about service. We had a great meeting. So I don't mind sucker punching a little bit. Sometimes it's just a good way. You got to tote the little message in there and slip it to them. But a whole bunch of stuff like that, that's a whole different workshop. But this whole business of getting beyond ourselves, and we'll deal with that some when we get into 10, 11, and 12. And, that's one of the fun places in this program for me. And that whole business of how we get in out of this sort of staring at my navel and fixing me and all this, and start looking how we get this dude working in the world and getting back into the race. Now, what do we do, Tony? What do we do? Quit, break, or what?
Take another break, and then we'll finish up at 5. Come back.
All right, yeah, and we'll do. I tell you what, we'll do 8 and 9, and then the next session we'll go over the 10 through 12. Okay, good deal.
Two comments.
Well, that question, sponsoring after a year of service, should be contingent on have you worked the 12 steps. As a sponsor, don't we need to have those 12 steps under our belts before we can teach them to somebody else?
Go ahead.
that was my question.
Yeah.
You know, you say you should, if you've been sober a year, you should be sponsored.
You should bring the mic over to my table because I'll throw some questions or some replies back to you. A lot of those I dropped.